From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a rare conversation with Gary Larson, the creator of the Far Side comic strip. It's been about 3 years since he stopped drawing his popular daily cartoon. Now he's got a new book called There's a Hair in My Dirt, which begins around the dinner table of a family of earthworms. Larson's zillions of devoted fans want to know how his strange mind works. We'll see what we can find out. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new collections of music by Kurt Weill, sung by Weill himself, as well as by Lottie Lenya, Danny Kaye, and others. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Authorities in Carmel, Indiana, report that one person was killed during a bank robbery today. Police say a man walked into a branch of Key Bank in the suburb north of Indianapolis. He demanded money and began shooting. Three people were wounded. This robbery was followed by a robbery attempt at a different bank a few miles away. There, a man shot at police officers responding to the scene. They returned fire. That man was apprehended. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright met Chinese President Jiang Zemin and Premier Zhu Rongji today. She suggested the Clinton administration would consider relaxing sanctions if China makes progress on U.S. concerns. The sanctions were imposed after the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
Both China and the U.S. have described Madeleine Albright's meetings here with China's top leaders as friendly and constructive, setting the right tone for President Clinton's visit in late June. But China made it clear that one point is not negotiable. Foreign Ministry spokesman Tang Guoqiang indicated that the government is not about to admit that it was wrong in ordering troops to crush the 1989 Tiananmen Square demonstration.
They seriously disrupted social order and undermined national security. The Chinese government had to adopt necessary measures to resolve it resolutely.
China has called on the U.S. to drop all remaining post-Tiananmen sanctions against China. Mary Kay Magstead, NPR News, Beijing.
The Irish Republican Army has rejected part of a proposed peace accord for Northern Ireland, but the IRA cleared the way for its ally, Sinn Féin, to accept the agreement. The IRA was refusing to decommission its weapons. That process is supposed to start in June and take 2 years. From London, Alan Dow filed this report for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
The Irish Republican Army says the multi-party peace agreement is a significant development, but IRA commanders say on its own it's not a solid basis for a lasting settlement, and they will not hand over any weapons. The peace deal struck earlier this month did not determine a deadline for decommissioning of weapons, but the parties, including Sinn Féin, agreed it would be discussed later this year. Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Molam says that was the deal. There's no room for backpedaling.
The agreement is part of an overall package. People can't choose and pick which bits they'd like or dislike.
The Protestant Unionist parties are furious over the IRA's announcement. They are already having a tough time selling this agreement to their constituents. The thought of a well-armed IRA simply lying dormant will make getting a Protestant yes vote in next month's referendum even more difficult.
Alan Dow reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 153 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the markets are buzzing over new government figures. The Dow climbed more than 130 points at the opening bell after the Commerce Department revealed strong gross domestic product numbers. NPR's Madeline Brand reports.
Unexpectedly, the economy grew by 4.2% in the first quarter of this year. Analysts give some credit to the balmy winter weather, which spurred retail sales and construction spending. The government also announced that wages and benefits grew only modestly, 0.7%, in the first quarter, thereby dispelling fears of inflation. In fact, inflation is at its lowest level in 35 years. The two reports lifted spirits on Wall Street. The stock and bond markets jumped in early trading on belief that now the Federal Reserve can hold off raising rising interest rates. One economist says today's figures debunk the notion that a strong economy leads to rapid inflation. Madeline Brand, NPR News, Washington.
This is the third day of hearings into the conduct of Internal Revenue Service investigators. One IRS auditor told a panel of senators some IRS managers overlook millions of dollars of outstanding tax bills in their hurry to close cases. Auditor Maureen O'Dwyer says in one case, a corporation owed $24 million in taxes, but her manager ordered her to close the case so he could earn a $2,000 agency bonus for finishing cases early. Two major airlines may decide to link up after all. United and Delta Airlines have created a tentative alliance that would link their routes and their frequent flyer programs. Delta and United would also be able to sell seats on each other's flights. American Airlines and U.S. Airways announced a similar pact just last week. The agreement must still be approved by pilot unions. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cartoonist Gary Larson has devoted fans all over the world. His weird and surreal comic, The Far Side, was syndicated in more than 1,900 newspapers around the world and translated into 17 languages. 21 of his Far Side books have been bestsellers. Larson retired from drawing The Far Side 3 years ago. Now he has a new illustrated book about a family of earthworms called There's a Hair in My Dirt. It's a kind of twisted fairy tale which he describes as an adult children's book.
It's centered on a family of worms that are sitting around the dinner table like one night. And they're having their usual dinner. The only thing they always ever have, which is dirt. So they have these little plates of dirt in front of them. And on this one occasion, the little worm, the little kid worm, sees that there's a hair in his dirt. And that, I mean, just completely infuriates him. And just, he's so upset by it. And he just has this tirade and goes off about, you know, the life of a worm and just how miserable he is and on and on. So he has this big scene at the dinner table, and his mother and father worm are just sitting there listening to him vent. And he finishes, and finally father worm looks at him and decides he has to tell him a story. And that's sort of where the main book begins. It's actually the story being told by the father worm to his son, and he tries it. It centers on trying to tell him the importance of being a worm, that his life is not so bad, and that in essence all things play a role in nature, and he uses this story to explain it.
Gary Larson, this book is based on a short set of drawings and captions, like a short strip that you did about 15 years ago.
Right.
How did you first come up with the story?
I guess I was hearing, maybe this goes back to my childhood, because I always had an affinity for animals that lived in swamps especially snakes. And I always liked snakes and caught them and brought them home. And I had very tolerant parents, I think, that allowed you to bring things into the house like that and set up little cages and terrariums and whatever. And that has always stayed with me. I've even on into my 20s, I had a real strong interest in reptiles and amphibians. And when you do that, you start to get, start to obviously encounter a lot of reactions from people who walk into your place and are horror stricken about what they see, and it always made you feel like you had to explain yourself, and I just never had any fear of those things at all, and I thought they were beautiful, and it started me thinking about, is it me or is it you? Why is someone else looking at this and saying it's ugly or whatever? And I started to realize that maybe we all bring prejudice to nature as well when we decide what's beautiful and what's ugly, or what's dramatic and impressive and what's not. And because everything is just looks the way it looks because it's...
One of your comics is of a snake that's coiled up, but it's sitting on a couch in a living room. And, of course, the snake has the same patterns. The snake's skin is the same pattern as the couch's upholstery.
Right.
So the couch is kind of, the snake is kind of like camouflaged in the living room,
right,
the way snakes usually are camouflaged in the woods. Did you have snakes in the house that got out and hid out in the living room?
Oh, I did. I used to, yeah, they would get loose every once in a while. And my folks were never real pleased about that, but still they never put their foot down. But yeah, well, I usually could find them eventually.
Usually, all right.
Yeah.
Sounds awful.
Yeah. I know my, I lost an 8-foot boa constrictor once in our house, and my dad and I went on a search for it, and we were looking everywhere and could not find this thing. And my mom was gone. She wasn't even aware, but I knew I had to find it before she got home. And I remember I was in the living room looking behind the couch or whatever, and I heard my dad scream from another room. And he said, well, actually what he said, he yelled, "I found it." And then the scream came out of him.
What happened?
Well, nothing. Actually, the snake didn't do anything. He had reached up. My mom had like a sewing machine or something. It was, and he had reached up inside. You know, well, actually, the cabinet that it was in, and he didn't look. He just put his hand up inside this thing and was feeling, and he put his hand right on it, and it was really funny because he had this reaction was to first of all say that he found it, and then it sort of hit him that he'd found it. and this scream.
You have done so many comics, Gary Larson, about insects and creatures and wildlife and animals and so on, that there's been a couple of creatures named after you. One of them is a louse, as in lice.
Yeah.
And you reprinted in one of your books the letter that the biologist sent you, the biologist who wanted to name the louse after you. And he said, let me warn you, I do not work on cute insects. I am a specialist on the order Malaphaga, which is the chewing lice. I hope I pronounced
right.
that right.
Right.
But were you honored?
I was honored. I was very honored. Yeah, I was. That was a great compliment. I don't know if everyone feel that way, but I did. I mean, and the fact that it was a chewing louse was fine.
Did you get to ever see this chewing louse?
I've never seen it, no.
And what's it officially called?
You mean as in like a common name or what?
Well, now that it's named after you, is it called the Gary Larson louse?
No, it's Larsoni, I think, is the species or subspecies name on it. And I can't, right now, you've caught me off guard. I can't think of the genus name.
And you have a butterfly named after you, too?
Yeah.
And what's that?
I sort of forget what that is. I don't know too much about the butterfly. I was more drawn to the louse.
In a lot of your comics, you try to see the world through the eyes of insects and animals, and the human world looks, you know, often very absurd when seen through the eyes of insects and animals. In one of your very funny comics, there's a movie theater filled with insects, and they're watching a horror movie called Return of the Killer Windshield.
Right.
I think it's very funny. What kind of things do you wonder about when you wonder about what an insect's point of view is like? Do you spend a lot of time doing that, thinking, I wonder how the world looks to the insects that we kill when we drive quickly on the highway?
Well, I suppose I do. But, you know, it's always been confusing to me as well as to try to understand how or where this idea came from, how I got there.
With the idea of that particular cartoon or just it, ideas in general?
In general, because now, I mean, I'm thinking about the cartoon you mentioned and I'm going, well, how did I think of that? And why did that come to me? I imagine I am starting to think about their world and looking at it and what it would be like and what are the threats and dangers and encounters that they have in their world and what do I know about them and their lives and life cycles and start thinking like that.
My guest is Gary Larson, the creator of the syndicated comic The Far Side. Now he has a new book called There's a Hair in My Dirt, A Worm's Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Cartoonist Gary Larson is my guest of the Far Side fame. He has a new book, and it's called There's a Hair in My Dirt, and it's told from the point of view of earthworms. We've been talking about real creatures. I want to talk about monsters a little bit. You have some great monster comics that you've done over the years, and one of them, a monster couple is sitting at the kitchen table, they're drinking coffee, and Mr. Monster says, "Dang, look at the time, and I got to be in little Billy Harrison's closet before nightfall." Did you think that there were lots of monsters in your house when you were a boy, hiding out?
I did. I was, well, I'll tell you this. I had a real fear of my closet when I was a kid. And I was convinced that something lived in my closet. And I had this little ritual as a result that every night when I went to bed, I made sure that the closet doors, I had two sliding doors, I made sure they were completely shut before I went to bed. And one night I was in bed and I had my reading lamp on, and I think I was like reading a comic book or something. And I looked up to check on the closet because I was always checking on the closet. And the door was open like, half an inch or so. And I just was mortified. I couldn't believe that I had done this. I had overlooked it. And, of course, I also knew that I couldn't get up and go shut the door because that's just what the thing inside wanted me to do. And I didn't want to walk across the room to turn the light on. And so I just laid there, and I was really in a cold sweat, wondering what to do about this. And I went back to reading for a while. And I looked up again, like half a minute later. And I wasn't sure, but I thought that maybe the door was now a little wider, that it opened a little. But if it had, it was very subtle. And I looked down again and looked up once more. And this time I was convinced it was like an inch open, wide open. And now all I could do was just stare at it. And I was just staring at this closet. And I found myself trying to look into this black slit into the closet. And eventually I could make out an eye staring back at me, just one eye looking at me. And this primal scream came out of me. And at the same time that I was screaming, the door just slid open very slowly, just before my eyes, and my brother stepped out. He I don't know how long he'd been hidden in there, but he knew I had this fear, and he was just milking it out.
Oh, he had your number.
Oh boy, did he. Yeah.
So did that reinforce or end your fear of the closet?
Oh, it didn't end anything for me.
what did you expect the monsters would look like, since you've drawn a lot of monsters over the years?
I think the monsters that I saw in my mind were very werewolf-like, I think.
Lots of hair, big fangs.
Yeah.
Partly human, partly animal.
Actually, and I realize again, my older brother had a big influence on me, because he had when we shared a bedroom, he had a dream one night in which, and he woke up screaming, and my mom came running in to see what was wrong, and he described this dream to her of being in a basement somewhere, and this wolf that walked on its hind legs was trying to get him, and the wolf kind of shuffled its feet, and he could hear him coming, and he described the sound of these feet going shh, shh, shh down the hallway toward him. And when it finally showed up, it was this huge wolf on its hind legs, and it didn't have any pupils. It just had pure white eyes. And it became sort of famous in our household as known as the wolf with the pure white eyes. And he completely forgot about it after he woke up. But for me, his dream haunted me for the longest time. And I think I kind of absorbed his dream, that story, and worried about that wolf somewhere in our house for years.
Now, as an adult, you came up for one of your cartoons with a good device to protect against monsters. It's the monster snorkel. And
yeah.
It allows a child to stay under the covers, hidden from the monsters, while still breathing through this snorkel. And, you know, in reading that, it made me think that, you know, in my fear of monster era, I had to vigilantly stay with my head outside of the covers, because as long as I was watching, they probably wouldn't come. See, so if I was under the covers, that's when I'd be vulnerable.
Oh, no, that was very different from my own private version of how to survive. I could have suffocated maybe some nights. I just did not want to expose any part of me, I thought.
It's interesting that you were on the one hand so attracted to, you know, like snakes and kind of creepy, crawly type things that would scare a lot of people. And on the other hand, you were really afraid of monsters.
Mm-hmm. Well, literally, it was. I guess that's the difference between day and night for me.
Oh, sure, yeah,
because
right.
Yeah, but in the daylight, I was into nature, and I read books on biology and natural history, and I studied about snakes and other animals. I mean, I was really into that. But boy, when the sun went down, it's like, oh, this is another world.
When do you work now? During the day or at night?
I work usually, I start late afternoon, I guess, and go into the night.
Is night a good time to work for you now?
Yeah.
Why is that, do you think?
It suits me, I guess. I like to, I sit at my drafting tables in the corner of a room, and I usually put some jazz on or something, and everything is quiet and elsewhere, and I can concentrate.
Do you still ever have really bad dreams at night, or just kind of thoughts that come to haunt you? Is the night still, in its own way, threatening?
No, I got through it. I mean, I don't have those kind of thoughts anymore.
You have a comic, you know, you've spoken of your brother a little bit and some of the practical jokes and so on. He played on you. You have a cartoon where the character, who I assume is based on you, is tied to a tree while the older brother is coming at him with a match so large that it looks more like a torch than a match. Did your brother, like, do things to torture you?
Oh, well, I had to watch out for myself, I guess. I was often saved by the bathroom, which was the only room with a lock on it, of course, to escape. But mostly things like hiding in the closet, mm-hmm. whatever. But
yeah.
Sometimes it got physical. But
if you don't mind my asking, I know one of the books is dedicated to the memory of your brother. What happened to him?
Oh, he had a heart attack about 4 years ago, a massive heart attack, and died. And caught us all off guard, and he was, now when we look back on it, we realize he was, overweight, and he had high blood pressure and high cholesterol, and a lot of things going against him, but still we were all sort of shocked. He was 46.
That's young.
Yeah. So.
Do you still do cartoons about him, or do you feel like that would be off limits now, or?
Oh, no, I don't think it'd be off limits. I think these are some of my memories, and I wouldn't want to ignore them, I guess, and he wouldn't want me to.
Gary Larson is my guest. Did you read a lot of comics as a kid?
Yeah.
What did you read?
I read mostly Tarzan comics.
It's funny that you should choose Tarzan, because he's out in the jungle. You know, there's a lot
right.
of wildlife.
Yeah. Yeah, and
monkeys, other animals,
exactly. Yeah,
swinging from branch to branch of trees. And
yeah, those could take me away in my imagination. And actually, I used to read Edgar Rice Burroughs' books, Tarzan books. And fact is, I had a, I remember there was one Tarzan book that had a dictionary in the back that Burroughs had made up this language of the great apes, and I memorized it.
Do you remember any of it?
I remember Kriga Bandulo. those came up a lot. I think that was Beware Kill.
No, you have one of your comics is about comics. And let me see if I could describe it. There's a kind of misshapen middle-aged couple that's answering the doorbell after it rings, and they've opened the door to find two strangers. And the strangers are drawn in a completely different kind of way than the couple who's opened the door. The strangers are drawn in this kind of mainstream, attractive way with kind of bolder, darker lines. And the funny-looking couple, after opening the door, says, "Oh, man, you must be looking for apartment 3G, Mary Worth, or one of those other, quote, serious cartoons." This cartoon made me think of how you see your cartooning style compared to other newspaper cartooning styles over the years. So let me ask you to talk about that a little bit. How you see your style visually fitting in with other cartoons and comics that you've seen over the years in newspapers?
Well, I guess I never saw it as really fitting in very well. And as a matter of fact, when I started drawing, I never thought of newspapers as being the eventual home for my work. I was more inspired by the cartoonists that worked in magazines, and you know, and they were all the single panel cartoons like mine, and they didn't have names. I didn't have a name. The Far Side for my cartoon. I was surprised when they told me they wanted to give it a name. And I said, "Do we really have to do that?" I was just extremely naive about newspaper comics, and so there I was. I mean, I ended up on the comic page of where I'd be sometimes juxtaposed with Nancy or something, and it's strange. Well, I think that's where the Far Side actually had a lot of trouble in the beginning, because I had a lot of resistance from both editors and readers, and it was this. These collisions were taking place of people who were just got finished reading Nancy, and their eyes would go over and see this strange thing next to it.
Gary Larson is the creator of the comic The Far Side. His new book is called There's a Hair in My Dirt. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Here's music that guitarist Bill Frisell composed for an animated version of Tales from the Far Side. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with cartoonist Gary Larson and find out how he started drawing in the first place. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new collections of Kurt Weill recordings. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with cartoonist Gary Larson. He retired 3 years ago from drawing his popular syndicated cartoon, The Far Side. Now he has a new illustrated book, which he describes as an adult children's book. It's called There's a Hair in My Dirt, A Worm's Story. Now, you've said that you don't think of yourself as a very good artist in terms of drawing, that you that mm-hmm. there's a limit to your capacities in drawing. How did you start drawing, and how did you feel about it when you started?
Started drawing The Far Side?
No, just drawing in general.
In general? Well, yeah. I was real little. I was drawing since I can remember. And I was serious about it then. I wasn't drawing like cartoons. I mean, they probably looked like cartoons, but I was drawing whales and dinosaurs and right. things like that. And I was always interested in it. And that was another thing. My folks encouraged. I mean, they always kept me supplied in paper and whatever. So I've never considered myself to be a great... I think I can communicate something. I draw well enough to get something across. And I think sometimes there's a risk. And I see it, I think, with some people, and they draw so well, they almost kill the life of something, you know, of the humor. I think there's nuances that you have to concentrate on. And if you get those down, the rest of it's not as essential.
Well, with your comics, the way they're drawn, they're kind of drawn as if they're your thought balloon or something. It's like what's going on in your mind as opposed to what's going on in the real world. So the fact that everything's a little eccentric in how it's drawn, it seems to be the way it should be, because it's about your sensibility as opposed to the actuality of the fact of the world.
Yeah, right. The things that I draw that generally come from inside me. I know of cartoonists who ideas are triggered by something. And this has happened to me too. Someone will say something or you'll be somewhere, or, you know, and it'll just hit you like that. But for me, I relied mostly on just sitting down at the drafting table and starting to let myself go, and I would call up things from inside me, that either experiences or something I knew from my education or my background or something, and my sense of humor is the same sense of humor that my entire family has. It's the kind of things that happen around the dinner table, and so yeah, it's definitely from within, I guess.
Did you ever think that you would be doing this professionally, or did it just seem like a hobby?
Oh, I had no idea in the world that I would do this professionally. This is such a weird thing to have happened. I look back on it. I just, you know, it's just one of those things. I rolled the dice and tried it and paid off. And boy, did it. When I first started, I just wanted to pay the rent. That was my fantasy. Gee, could you actually do something you like to do and make a living at it? And as soon as it reached that level, I was totally satisfied that this is great.
Now, if memory serves and if what I read was accurate, you started off drawing doing cartoons for a Seattle paper,
mm-hmm.
and then took them to the San Francisco Chronicle,
mm-hmm.
where... an editor, much to your surprise, actually liked them a lot,
mm-hmm.
and asked you to stay on with them and draw for them. And I think it was the people at the Chronicle who named it The Far Side.
Yes, yeah.
What did you think of the title?
I thought it was fine. They said, we'd like to call it The Far Side. What do you think of that? And I said, well, sounds good to me. And I guess it sounded good to me because it didn't lock it in a whole lot. I was worried you're going to give it a name of some character, whatever, Ernie or something, you know, and I didn't want to have that. I wanted to have some freedom in it. And they also wanted me to develop maybe characters like Charlie Brown or something that would always come back, because they said that's what's been proven about newspaper comics, is that readers need that familiarity of seeing the same character come back over and over again. And that's where I said, I just didn't know if I could do that. Well, one of the reasons I didn't think I could do it because I didn't even know if I could draw 6 cartoons a week. I didn't know where my ideas were going to come from or if I could do this year after year or, well, week after week. And I signed this contract that said I would do it thinking, I probably won't go to prison if I can't. And it's my, you know, why not? I'll give it a shot. And
well, did they want the Far Side to at least be some kind of positioning statement that this is something that would imply in its way that this is going to be a surreal comic? It's going to be an odd comic.
The name?
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's what they were going for. They actually sprang another name on me, and I can't remember the complete name, but I know the word underbelly was in it.
didn't like that?
No. Well, I don't even remember exactly what it was, but they had themselves said they thought the Far Side was a better name for it.
Well, was it hard when you actually signed on to do, what, 6 a week?
Yeah.
Was it hard to do them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. Well, I was terrified, too. I just didn't know if I could do that. I almost lied by saying I could. And actually, they wanted me, and I did. I sent 8 a week when I started because they wanted to have the luxury, of course, of, you know, editing out a couple. But before that, I was just doing a weekly cartoon. And I was having a hard time coming up with that. And I put a lot of thought. But the thing that happens that I discovered as time went by is... It actually gets easier. I think it's almost like you teach yourself how to think, and it's like you start getting chops or something by doing it, forced to be doing it day after day.
Was there a first comic that you can think of that got this really big reaction and made you realize, oh, people are paying attention and they're responding?
Yeah, that happened to me with a very strange cartoon, I have to concede. I drew this cartoon showing a cow. Yeah, what else? But a cow standing in front of a workbench, looking out at the reader. And on the workbench were these just amorphous shapes. And there's like a barn in the background, whatever, this little scene. And I titled it Cow Tools. And I had been thinking, I remember how I got to this idea, was I was thinking about how anthropologists used to define mankind as being, or man as being the only animal that made and used tools. And then they subsequently discovered that, well, even some birds and primates do that, so they had to change the definition a little. But I started thinking about, well, what if cows started made tools, what would they make? And my intention was that, well, you don't know what they are, only the cow knows what they are. And, you know, here are this display of tools that a cow would use and only a cow knows. But the reaction was unbelievable. I thought it was the end of my career, honestly, because I just started getting a barrage of phone calls and letters and
saying what?
Well, it's saying, what does it mean? And that's what happened, is that everyone was just utterly confused by it. And I think there was one newspaper that posted some kind of a reward or something for anyone that could figure it out. And that was the first time that I realized that, you know, more than 6 people were looking at it. I had no idea.
And the fact that they didn't get it and it confused them really mattered somehow.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very confusing week for me. I was trying to sort out, what does this mean? I can't describe what that was like. It was just very strange. I mean, I lived in a little basement apartment and, you know, by myself and drew these things once a week. It's a very isolated kind of existence. And I'd mail them once a week into my editor and we'd maybe talk about them.
Who was in a different city than you?
Yeah,
it
was in a different city, yeah. And then one day this thing happened. And I had, it was incredible. After I got through it, I realized, well, I guess this is good news. But at the time, I thought, oh, geez, you don't do this. I mean, you don't confuse people.
Did you print an explanation or a follow-up comic?
I did a lot of interviews about it. Oddly enough, doing something that wasn't funny but just confusing probably did more promotional work for me than anything else. It's just strange how that worked out. But I had a listed phone number and everything. So, I mean, I was just picking up the phone and find myself talking to some reporter and explaining it.
My guest is Gary Larson, the creator of the syndicated comic The Far Side. Now he has a new book called There's a Hair in My Dirt, A Worm's Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gary Larson. Now, I know one of the things that you've done over the years that gives you a lot of pleasure is listen to music and play music. And I think even before you were a cartoonist that you played guitar and banjo in bands.
Yeah, well, I started off playing banjo when I was like 12 or 13, I think. And
Was it the Pete Seeger Learn How to Frail approach?
No, this is sort of embarrassing for me. I mean, for being basically a shy person, I don't know what made me pick up the banjo, which is this instrument that screams, you know, look at me, I'm playing a banjo. I started playing a four-string plectrum banjo, which was, I don't know if it was like, it might have been in vogue in like the 20s or something, but it was like ragtime or Dixieland or what have you. I really worked at it. I learned to play it. And I think a few years later, the movie Bonnie and Clyde came out, and of course, Foggy Mountain Breakdown on a five-string banjo, which is, you know, as you know, totally different from a four-string. So, I mean, not only did I choose a strange instrument, but I didn't even choose the one that became real popular and was real cool to play. So, then I finally switched to guitar, I guess, in my early 20s. It's funny, I was just talking to I'm still in touch with my old college roommate, and we're still good friends. And he finally confessed to me that, I think he said, you know, we thought we were going to have to kill you back then, because I would practice the banjo, you know, and I never thought about it. Of course, that would drive someone insane. But
what about guitar? What was your guitar playing like, or what is your guitar playing like?
Well, I became interested in jazz, and that's where I've been ever since. And suddenly one day I discovered, gee, the guitar is very expressive and wonderful, and I've just been at it ever since, and I love it.
I know you've done some studying with the great jazz guitarist Jim Hall. Did you approach him? And he lives on the East Coast, and you live on the West.
Yes, yeah.
How did this work?
Well, we had a mutual friend in a guitar maker, a guy that passed away named Jimmy DeQuisto, and I was talking to Jimmy one day and said, and he was just saying, hey, you ought to call up Jim Hall and see if you can get some lessons from him. I thought, God, if that could happen, that would just be a miracle. And so I don't know what happened next, but yeah, I approached him, or maybe through Jimmy. I don't remember how it happened, but he was willing to do it. And wow, it was fantastic.
So did you fly to the East Coast to take lessons with him?
Yeah, I did. My wife and I actually moved to the village area and lived there for a few months.
Wow.
For one summer, and I'd go up there and take lessons from him a couple times a week. And I also linked up with another guitarist named Remo Palmier and took from him as well. So, it was just a wonderful experience for me, a great summer. That was during my sabbatical.
Does playing still give you a lot of pleasure?
Yeah. Yeah, it's... It's just great. I think when I mean, it's frustrating for me too. I mean, when you're a student of it and you want to be better and you keep practicing and
when your ear is more sophisticated than your ability
exactly,
to play.
Exactly. But everything else, you know, when I'm playing the guitar, all other troubles seem to melt away and I'm just absorbed in it. So I guess it's a form of therapy in a way too.
I want to ask you about a story that that you've told in one of your books, and that I want to hear more about. Before you started working full-time as a cartoonist, you had a job with the Seattle Humane Society investigating cases of animal cruelty toward animals.
Right.
And on your way to the job interview, apparently you ran over a dog.
I did.
What happened?
I did. That's the most unbelievable thing that's probably ever happened to me. That's the only time I've ever hit an animal, I think, driving. And I'm on my way to an interview with the Humane Society. I look back on it now and see the irony in it and everything. But at the time, it's mortifying when something like that happens. And I was out on a kind of a rural road, and it was like a pack of dogs. And they just, I don't know where they appeared from, but they were just heading from one side of the road to the other. They came out from the woods and were heading across the street, probably chasing a deer. And one of them, I just nailed it, hit it, thumped it really hard with the right front fender. And I stopped and I looked back and I saw the dog, and he actually moved off. He went on back off into the woods with the other dogs. But there's no way that he didn't feel that or something or happened to him. So I never knew what became of the dog or whatever, but I don't.
Well, there's no way you're going to go after him and be in all this pack of dogs that you didn't know.
It's kind of hard to describe the setting, but that didn't seem really plausible at the time and the way things were happening and whatever. But and it was all pretty fast. It wasn't like he was lying in the road there or something like that. It was almost as if he wasn't injured, in fact, but he had to have been. So
did you show up to the interview with blood on your fender?
No. I was kind of rattled about it, though.
Well, I can imagine,
sitting there being interviewed, and I was like, oh, yes, and
murderer.
The way, I
just,
yeah.
I would like to end our interview with some music, and since you listen to so much music and enjoy it so much, I thought I'd ask you to choose a favorite record.
I've always liked the recordings by Paul Desmond and Jim Hall. That's some of the music that I listen to a lot when I work.
And Jim Hall's a jazz guitarist who you've studied with, so.
Yeah, he's just great.
Okay, well, we'll close with that. Gary Larson, such a pleasure to meet you and talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Gary Larson is the creator of the comic The Far Side. His new book is called There's a Hair in My Dirt. And here's a track from a Jim Hall, Paul Desmond session that he mentioned. Coming up, new CDs featuring music by Kurt Weill. This is Fresh Air. The Kurt Weill phenomenon shows no signs of slowing down. Weill died in 1950, at the age of 50, but 2 years before his centennial, record companies are rushing to put out recordings of his music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of some of them.
Last year, Pearl Records issued an important double CD retrospective of Kurt Weill recordings called From Berlin to Broadway that featured his most famous partner, Bertolt Brecht, singing their most famous song, Mack the Knife. On Volume 2, which Pearl has just released, we can now hear Kurt Weill himself singing songs from his biggest Broadway hit, One Touch of Venus, which had wonderfully literate lyrics by, of all people, the nonsense poet Ogden Nash. The original Broadway star was Mary Martin. Later, Hollywood filmed it with Ava Gardner, but most of Weill's delightful score was eliminated. Here's Kurt Weill himself singing with affecting understatement one of his most insinuating romantic ballads, Speak Low.
Speak low, when you speak low, our summer day with us away, too soon. Speak low, when you speak low, our moment is swift like ships adrift, we are swept apart too soon. Speak low, darling, speak low, love is a spark lost in the dark, too soon. I feel wherever I go that tomorrow is near, tomorrow is here, and always too soon. Time is so old and love so brief. Love is pure gold and time.
Weill's most famous American song, September Song, was introduced by Walter Huston in the 1938 musical Knickerbocker Holiday that Weill collaborated on with playwright Maxwell Anderson. This new Berlin to Broadway set includes Huston in an abbreviated 1945 radio broadcast of the whole show. There are cover recordings in French and Hebrew that show how quickly Weill's music entered the international repertoire. And it's fascinating to compare these to some of the rare early recordings by the most famous Weill singer of all, his wife Lotte Lenya. The most bizarre selection on this album is something called Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, Weill's four patriotic melodramas, orchestrations he made in 1942 of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, the Star Spangled Banner, the Pledge of Allegiance, and Walt Whitman's call to arms, Beat, Beat Drums. These are recited with over-the-top fervor by the so-called First Lady of the American stage, Helen Hayes. They're morbidly fascinating period pieces.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
Danny Kaye became a star in another Broadway show composed by Weill, Lady in the Dark, the first musical about psychoanalysis. Kaye couldn't be on the original cast recording with Gertrude Lawrence because he was contracted to another label. So he recorded his own selections from Lady in the Dark, including Gertrude Lawrence's numbers. These now appear both on Berlin to Broadway and on Sony's reissue of Lady in the Dark, starring opera singer Reza Stevens, which is the most complete recording of this fascinating score, though it loses the sharp edge of the original cast. Sony has also reissued Lotte Lenya's great 1956 album of Weill's Berlin Theater Songs, coupled with her marvelous recording of Weill's Seven Deadly Sins. When Sony first issued Berlin Theater Songs on CD, I was upset that they used a shortened version of Lenya's devastating Surabaya Johnny. I'm happy to report that on this new issue, the complete version is finally available.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Kurt Weill from Berlin to Broadway, Volume 2, on the Pearl label, and other Kurt Weill recordings on Sony Masterworks. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross.
Surabaya Johnny, warum bist du so rot? Surabaya Johnny, mein Gott, und ich liebe dich so. Surabaya Johnny, warum bin ich nicht froh? Du hast kein Herz, Johnny, und ich liebe dich so.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.